Afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Jamshed Barucha, and I'm the Provost and Senior Vice President of Tufts University, and it's my distinct pleasure to welcome you all here. We are very fortunate today to have one of the outstanding diplomats and statesmen of our time, Richard Holbrooke, here to be with us. As you know, his involvement with our administration's policies in Pakistan and Afghanistan put him right at the center of a lot of the conflict going on today. And so I couldn't decide whether I should be happy or unhappy about the fact that he's taking time away from saving the world to be with us today. But one of the many things that makes Tufts such an extraordinary university is that we take seriously our role of preparing our students to be global leaders. At many institutions, many that I'm very familiar with, global leadership is cited all the time, but I think at Tufts we have real substance in what we do to prepare our students to be global citizens. In my view, if you graduate today without being fluent, without having a fluent knowledge of parts of the world other than where we live, and a fluent knowledge of other cultures and how they interact and how they sometimes come into conflict with each other, I don't think that you're educated. So global citizenship requires a kind of global education, and that's what we're here to provide. The Institute for Global Leadership is one of our institutes at Tufts that provides these kinds of opportunities to students. And it's really been an extraordinary eye-opener for me to see how students' lives transformed by these kinds of experiences and this kind of education. Today's event was made possible by a number of people, but one of our former students, Dan Feldman, who was in the class of 90, who was in the EPIC class of 88, now works for Ambassador Holbrooke, and I understand he's the one who really set this up. So he's not able to be here today, and but he's responsible for doing this. It's very important that we keep in touch with our alumni, not just so we can raise money, but they can use their connections really to draw in outstanding speakers. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Ambassador Jonathan Moore, who was on our advisory board, external advisory board of the Institute for Global Leadership, and is a former ambassador himself. Please.
Thank you, Jamshed. Thank you all for coming. I'm actually from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, but I'm here today because of my gratitude for being as involved in the EPIC and the Institute for Global Leadership programs here at Tufts, and because I take every opportunity I can to participate in your wonderful work, and I'm talking particularly about the students, as Jamshed has mentioned. I also am a member of the external advisory board to the Institute for Global Leadership, which gives me a chance, obviously, to keep up to date and to partake. I first met Richard Holbrooke in 1969 when I was working with Elliot Richardson, who was then the Undersecretary of State. This was in the first year of the Nixon administration, and Richardson and I had the responsibility of dealing with personnel issues with the White House. And along comes a young Foreign Service officer named Dick Holbrooke, who had already had started out spectacularly a distinguished beginning to his career in service in Vietnam and on the Paris peace talks, and also working in the Johnson White House. Now, you might understand that that kind of background, Holbrooke's, and his activities as a young Foreign Service officer at that point might have attracted the attention of the White House, and not entirely in a positive way. Perhaps it was just pressing the State Department to be reminded of who was in charge, but we were under a lot of pressure on personnel appointments, ambassadorships, and other appointments. And perhaps Dick had aggravated somebody in the Nixon White House. I don't know. He certainly fine-tuned that quality throughout the rest of his career. But in any event, Richardson and I, wanting to resist the pushing of the White House not to appoint young Mr. Holbrooke to the job of being the head of the Peace Corps in Morocco, something the State Department wanted to assign him to and something he apparently wanted, they tried to block it. So Richardson and I, sort of in vain indulgence, were happy to take on the job of saving Dick Holbrooke's career. And indeed, when it was all said and done, he was approved and went to Morocco as the head of the Peace Corps. Now, the point of this story, of course, is to acknowledge that if there was ever someone who didn't need their career saved, it was Holbrooke. But we did not know that at the time. And later we came to rue our indulgence in our heroic act to keep his career alive, because he would have done it one way or the other and has over a period of time. So since then, he's been ambassador twice to the UN and to Germany. He's been an assistant secretary of state twice for the Far East for Europe. He has been a special envoy more times than that. And of course, as we all know, he was most instrumental in the Dayton Agreement, which ended the Bosnian War. And he has become the person whom American political leaders frequently now turn to undertake the impossible missions with the hope that he can make them possible. If it's tough, if it's impacted, if it's complicated, if it's nasty, if it's beyond the pale, people start looking around to see where Holbrooke is, to see if they can throw him at the problem. And he has become extraordinarily, he's proved his extraordinary value to the country in his willingness to take on, his appetite to take on these missions. However, it's, for me, speaking personally, there are attributes of Dick Holbrooke of a personal and a temperamental nature which are of special interest to me, and which I think contribute to, comprise, constitute, really, his special value. He is multi-talented, but in addition to the various multiple talents, there is an extra dimension, and I would briefly characterize it as involving special drive, tenacity, resourcefulness, ambition, as I said before, the appetite to take on, the energy to take on these assignments. Next, he is an intellect of action. He is a person who thinks and a person who acts. He is both analytical and operational in his drives and in his integration. He also manages in the assignments he takes on to calculate everything, to encompass all the various factors and interests and actors many of which are in competition with each other, and doesn't leave anything out, and tries to figure out what the weights and the rates of speed and the interaction of these various interests and actors are. And finally, he has the ability to perceive beyond the normal parameters of convention and current ways and formulas of looking at things. He's imaginative. He tries to go beyond that. So, for all these reasons, Richard, we are grateful for your service and appreciate your coming and spending time visiting and talking with us today, and to receive a cherished award that we have for you. And with that in mind, I would like to introduce Mara James. Please come up. Mara James is a senior at Tufts University. She's majoring in political science. She was active in the EPIC Symposium on South Asia this year. She has worked in Buenos Aires and in El Salvador, and she's worked for the Carter campaign, the Obama campaign. Way after my time. She also is conducting research currently at the National Archives, the National Security Archives in Washington, on comparing the Soviet war in Afghanistan with the current American war in Afghanistan. And with that, thank you, Mara, and will you do the honors?
Hello, my name is Mara, as Ambassador Moore said. I'm a student in this year's EPIC Colloquium on South Asia, and I'd like to thank you all for coming, in particular Ambassador Holbrooke for taking the time out of his busy schedule to address us. I have the honor of presenting the Dr. Jean Meyer Award today. Established in 1993, this award is given in honor of Dr. Jean Meyer, with the objective of bringing to Tufts scholars and activists who demonstrate moral courage, personal integrity, and a passion for scholarship. Dr. Meyer was a former president of Tufts and a world-renowned nutritionist who, over his lifetime, advised three U.S. presidents, participated in relief missions all over the world, and pushed our university in the direction of assuming larger responsibilities to improve society and the world environment. His personal philosophy was that scholarship, research, and teaching must be dedicated to solving pressing world problems. Over the past 7 months, we EPIC students have immersed ourselves in South Asia, particularly in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Despite all the time we've spent attempting to engross ourselves in the region, most of us can only talk in the abstract about the conflict. We can spew figures, names, and dates with amazing precision. We can tell you about the Khyber Pass, Pakistani military spending, Massoud, Deobandism, Ismail Khan, DDR, SSR, Abdul Rashid Dostum, the Shavarik district, and so on. But we can only truly comprehend the situation as most of us, we cannot truly comprehend the situation as most of us have not experienced the conflict firsthand. We hope that today, Ambassador Holbrooke can give us some insight into the inner workings of U.S. policy in the region and shed some light on the reality on the ground. We could not have asked for a more qualified speaker on a more urgent topic. From his work as a Peace Corps director in Morocco to his time as Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs and later for European and Canadian Affairs, to his role as Chief Negotiator for the Dayton Peace Accords, to his time as Ambassador to Germany and later to the UN, and to his current post of Special Representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Ambassador Holbrooke has played a role in U.S. foreign policy since the Vietnam War. He's faced with the toughest foreign policy challenge that the U.S. faces today, and his life work, along with his extraordinary personal reputation, demonstrates to us that he is ready and able to address it. He exemplifies Dr. Jean Meyer's philosophy that with knowledge comes responsibility, and that we must never cease to push toward a more just world. It is with great pleasure that I invite Ambassador Holbrooke up to accept the Jean Meyer Award, in recognition of a distinguished career in diplomacy and negotiation, contending with the most challenging of global issues, and an admiration of your determination and tenacity to achieve the seemingly impossible. Thanks very much. You can hold it.
Thank you, Mara, for that wonderful treasure of an award. So you can turn the outside, but the continents don't move. There must be something symbolic in that. And Jonathan, thank you for that lovely and reasonably accurate introduction. It is true that I was working for the Johnson administration on Vietnam, very young junior officer in the Foreign Service. Nixon won in 68, and I was assigned to the office of the Deputy Secretary of State. And that became Elliot Richardson, who was a great man, and Jonathan Moore was his closest advisor. And those of you who don't know Elliot Richardson was, he was Attorney General, he was Secretary of Defense, he was head of the Law of the Sea negotiations. He had, there was another cabinet job. He had Commerce, HEW, Health, Education, Welfare, and Commerce. So he had four cabinet jobs. The only thing he wasn't good at was running for president. He really didn't do very well at that. But Jonathan stuck with him the whole way, and when Nixon became president, my time on Vietnam had come to an end, and I did ask to go into the Peace Corps as a director in Morocco. And Jonathan and Elliot made that possible, and for that I will always be grateful. I'm just delighted to be here today and to accept an award named after Jean Mayer, whom I did not know but of course knew about. He was a great figure, not just for Tufts, and much of modern Tufts is in his matrix he helped create it, but also he was a global citizen, and this award means a great deal to me. I spoke to members and former members of the Board of Tufts before coming up here who knew Jean Mayer, and they all said that this is the highest honor Tufts can offer. And I thank all of you for coming, and I thank Jamshad for his kind introduction. He mentioned Dan Feldman as one of my staff. Actually, I have four members of the staff who went here. Valley Nasser, who's with me today, and who still teaches up here. Rena Amiri, a brilliant Afghan-American who went to Tufts and used to work for the UN and who now we recruited out of the private world. Jessica Simon, a wonderful press officer. And so that's about 15% of my team went to Tufts, and I would count myself because I have an honorary degree from Tufts. So I did it the easy way, an honorary degree and this. So Tufts and Fletcher send its students all over the world. It's a great credential. And I hope that this tremendous turnout on a snowy day here in Boston speaks to your interest in continuing the tradition of public service. The Fletcher Dean, Steve Bosworth, is a close friend and colleague of mine. He's one of the great diplomats of this generation, really, truly great. And we're so delighted in Washington that Tufts is sharing them with us so we can deal with the North Koreans. I don't know if I can repeat what he told you, but Jamshad asked him who was worse to deal with, the North Koreans or the Tufts faculty. I'm sure you know what he said. But if you want to see a really the essence of a great professional diplomat, look at Steve Bosworth. He's as good as they get. He was in Manila at the height of a huge crisis when a dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, was about to be overthrown by a tremendous outpouring of people power, millions of people in the streets. And it could have been bloody, and Steve worked it through during the Reagan administration and eased Marcos out of power without a single life being lost. And it could have been an absolute nightmare. And that became an iconic moment for people uprisings all over the world, inspiring uprisings which failed in China and Burma, but succeeded in other countries, including ultimately Ukraine and Georgia. So Steve is a major figure in modern American diplomatic history, and Tufts is lucky to have him. Now, I'm not sure what would be more interesting to you today, for me to tell you about Afghanistan or talk a little bit about public service. But I want to start with public service because I haven't been here now in almost a decade. And this is, and I really hope that you will consider public service. And I want to stress that I don't necessarily mean going to Washington and working for the U.S. government. There are plenty of other ways to do it. You can work in your local communities. You can work in NGOs. You can go overseas and work directly. In Afghanistan today, there are about 980 civilians. We had 300 when I took over a year ago. Now we have about 980. But there are far more than that working in private NGOs and working in private organizations that are in contracts with the UN or the United States. So there are many ways you can serve, and I've already talked to several of you who are doing projects in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq already. So a tremendous number of things to do. I think that every generation, you should work at your own personal lives, your family lives, your business career, but give something back to the rest of the world. You are the privileged people, and the world has great need of people like you with talent who can give back. I myself followed a slightly different career path, but I went directly from college. I went to a school down the road in Providence, up on a hill there with a terrible football team called Brown. I went directly from Brown into the Foreign Service when President Kennedy was president, and he made his famous inaugural address when he asked us not to ask what the country could do for you, but what you could do for the country. And that inspired us. Some people joined the Peace Corps. Some went on freedom marches to help integrate the South. I went into the Foreign Service and went directly to Vietnam. And I served in Vietnam for 3.5 years, and I came back to Washington, where I met Jonathan after working on Vietnam for quite a while, in the White House, in the Pentagon, and in the peace talks with the North Vietnamese, then going on in Paris. And I put all that behind me and went on to a career, first the Peace Corps in Morocco, as Jonathan mentioned, and then I went into the private sector and became an editor, and came back into the government under President Carter as Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia, and then went back out when Reagan became president, and went into Wall Street and did a lot of NGO work, came back in with Clinton, and did the Dayton negotiations and ambassadorships in Germany and the UN, and we did a lot of other things. And then when the Bush administration, George W. Bush, took office, I went back into the private sector, and then I really devoted myself to NGOs and worked on, founded an organization on HIV/AIDS for a coalition, and created a cultural exchange center in Germany, and was chairman of Asia Society. And then when Barack Obama became president, he asked me to come back and do this job. And that kind of brought my career full circle, because things that I had never thought about for 20, 30 years from Vietnam suddenly became relevant again. We had failed in Vietnam, but one has to understand why we failed and what parts of the Vietnam experience were relevant to Afghanistan and what parts were not. So in a sense, my career is really from Vietnam to Afghanistan. President and Secretary Clinton gave me this extraordinary job to oversee just two countries, but to try to integrate the policies and deal with all the international ramifications of it. So I want to just start by answering the question you aren't asking, but I'm asked all the time, which is, what is Vietnam different from Afghanistan? Is Afghanistan the same as Vietnam? And I want to start by clarifying the core difference so that you all understand it. Now, most of you in this room don't remember Vietnam. It's as distant to you as World War I was to Jonathan and me when we were in the government. That's how far away it is. And I recognize that distance. But for the senior policymakers in the U.S. government, they grew up during the anti-Vietnam era. So you have to understand that Vietnam is a living memory for them, because they were kids when Vietnam was the number one issue in the country. And when an event like this was seething with anger and unrealized frustration at a war gone wrong. And the fundamental difference between Vietnam, which was the first American military defeat in our history, and Afghanistan, is that in Afghanistan, the situation poses a direct threat to our homeland. That was not true in Vietnam. The people we were fighting in Vietnam, the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, were a tightly disciplined communist organization which posed no direct threat to the homeland of the United States. And we stepped into it inch by inch through a series of miscalculations and a self-fulfilling rhetoric, but it didn't pose a threat to us. And yet 55,000 names are engraved on the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, which I'm sure many of you have visited. Afghanistan is different on the core reason. We're there because of what happened on September 11, 2001. That doesn't mean that we can automatically succeed, but we need to begin by understanding why we're asking young men and women, many of them the same age as you in this room, to risk their lives. They're all volunteers now in Vietnam. They were draftees, and that was a tremendous difference. Any of you in this room, at least the young men in this room, would have been liable to be called up if you didn't have a deferment, and then they went to a lottery system, and anybody could be called up. But today, our all-volunteer army knows why it's fighting. They understand that the people we're fighting, the Taliban and their allies, Al-Qaeda, who are hiding on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, are people who want to destroy America. They attacked us once. They've attacked London and Madrid, Bombay and Islamabad, Bali and Casablanca. And they say very publicly they want to do it again. And they invite nuclear scientists in Pakistan to turn over the keys to the Pakistani nuclear weaponry so they can do it, so they can attack us again. Let no one in this room doubt that if Al-Qaeda had had nuclear weapons on 9/11, they would have used them in New York and Washington. There's no question about that. Now, I want to be very careful here. I'm not arguing that that's axiomatic that our current strategy will or won't succeed. That's another issue I want to address in a moment. But I want to underscore, first and foremost, why we're in Afghanistan. Now, the situation there is difficult. The Obama administration inherited a mess beyond anything that you could have expected. I had been there several times as a private citizen. I'd written columns about it. I discussed corruption and weak governance and the fact that we had diverted our resources to Iraq. And I'd written, most importantly, that you couldn't fix Afghanistan unless you could deal with the Pakistani problem. But having said all that, neither I nor anyone else coming into the government was prepared for the shambles we inherited. And now 13 months and 2 weeks after Barack Obama became president, we spent most of last year trying to fix what we inherited and are finally beginning to get rolling on our proactive policies. Now, you all know about the military offensive that's going on in southern Afghanistan in the area of Helmand province. And I'll be happy to discuss that more during the questions and answers, but I don't want to divert too much on stuff which you can see on the TV tonight. I do want to emphasize something, however, which is not covered much in the press. And that is that alongside our soldiers are civilians who my office has recruited and are going in with the military at great personal risk because they're not equipped to fight and they have to be protected to help bring governance, good governance, agriculture, communications, rule of law with the troops. Cannot win this kind of war simply with military battles. This is not a military war of positions. It's a political struggle, and it will succeed or fail depending on the ability of the Afghan government to deliver services to the people and for the people to decide that they will take risks to support the government. And that has not been going well up to now. So we are putting massive effort into it. We will try to do that in every part of the country. It's very difficult. Afghanistan is the poorest country not in Africa in the world. There are four or five countries in Africa that are poorer. But even Haiti, before the earthquake, had a higher standard of living and a higher literacy rate than Afghanistan. This is a very traditional, highly tribal, ethnically diverse country, proud, intelligent people, but very poor and way undereducated. And half the people, that is the women, are in a condition which denies them the ability to participate in their country's life. And we have made a big effort to strengthen the role of women, which of course has caused a big backlash. So that's a separate problem. So I want to stress that our efforts in Afghanistan are, on the civilian side, which is what I'm responsible for, are to help the government strengthen itself, to reduce corruption, to help them create more democratic and more representative institutions, to bring rule of law. Now, that isn't easy. All of you who followed events last year know that the election held in August of last year was highly disputed, and there was massive irregularities on the side of all the major candidates, but more than anything, the election was compromised by that process. And it almost was a train wreck. It was very messy. But in the end, Hamid Karzai was reelected, and the people of Afghanistan accepted that result, but not without great difficulty. So the democratic imperative in Afghanistan is very difficult. On the other hand, you couldn't ignore it. Some people say to me, why did you waste time on the elections last year? It's not a democracy. It never was. It never will be. Why are you doing this? The reason was simple. It was called for in their own constitution, and you couldn't ignore it without creating an authoritarian and dictatorial and illegitimate regime. Now, having gotten through the election, we have to work with the Afghans to encourage them to deliver these services I mentioned to the people. That isn't going to be easy. Now, a word on Pakistan, and then I think I would like to take your questions. The border, which is disputed between the two countries, parts of it are disputed, is a mountainous border. It's the border over which Osama bin Laden and his colleagues escaped in 2001, 2002, which should never have been allowed to happen. And once they escaped, taking the Taliban with them, they nested in western Pakistan. And they looked around. They were defeated by the American offensive right after 9/11. They looked around and said, this is pretty hospitable territory. It's wild, savage country, soaring mountains, deep valleys, inaccessible ravines, caves everywhere. There's a very dramatic footage on television yesterday of some caves that were discovered, Al-Qaeda caves, which some of you may have seen. And there they nested, and they began to grow like a malignant tumor. And they began to destabilize western Pakistan. And they began to attack back into Afghanistan from their sanctuaries. American troops can't go into Pakistan. We can't do it. We're not welcome, and it would be a military disaster if we went in, because it would just gobble us up in the vastness of an area that we don't have connections to. So we are constrained in what we can do against the part of the enemy that's nesting in western Pakistan. There are some things we can do, and those results have been evident for all to see if you've been reading the papers in the last few months. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we captured, or we helped the Pakistanis capture, to be more specific, the number two man in the Taliban, Mullah Barada. That was a big deal. And other Taliban provincial governors have been killed or captured in recent weeks. There are also others who've died in recent months from attacks on them. So there is some signs of movement in that area. The Pakistanis themselves have started offensives against the Taliban in the West, and those offensives have been successful in the first three places they went into. Swat, the famous mountain ski resort which the Taliban took over and have now been driven out of, or at least driven out of the populated areas. South Waziristan, a wild and savage area. But what the Pakistanis have not yet been able to go into North Waziristan, which many people think is where bin Laden is holed up. We'll see. Their troops are stretched very thin, although they moved over 100,000 troops from the Indian border in the last year into the West to fight this. So we need to give Pakistan tremendous support. It's a very controversial issue. A lot of people don't want to give money to the Pakistanis. They think the Pakistanis abuse it, misuse it. But from my point of view, this is an easy decision. Pakistan's stability and its economic progress are essential for stability in the area, and we need to help them. Just as President Truman in 1947 asked the United States to help Greece and Turkey and began what is called the Truman Doctrine. I think the analogy fits. People thought the Turks and the Greeks were corrupt governments or right-wing governments, but history records that as a visionary act that began one of the great periods of American foreign policy. I believe the same thing applies in Pakistan. Senator Kerry, your senator here in the state, who's really one of the great leaders in the American foreign policy, has put forward a series of legislative proposals which passed last year to give the Pakistanis massive economic aid. And he will continue to do that, and we strongly support him. So what is our strategy here? Our goal is to disrupt the Taliban and create enough space and enough time for the Afghan government to get on its feet. We don't want to stay forever. As President Obama said in his speech on December 1st at West Point, the speech in which he announced that we were sending an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan, which would bring our total to just about 100,000 troops by the fall of this year. In that speech, President Obama said clearly that our commitment for troops is not open-ended, and that he would begin carefully calibrated reductions in American forces by July of next year. But we must stay there with economic aid. We must train the police and the army to take our place, or else our strategy will not succeed. It's going to be a difficult effort, and we need all the support we can get. First, from the international community. I've just returned from a trip to 10 countries in Central Asia, the Gulf, and South Asia itself, and Europe. And I'll be going back in 2.5 weeks to continue the effort to muster international support. That's one of the main things our office does. Vali Nasser and I were in Pakistan on that trip, and we'll be going back in a few weeks. And we need the support and understanding and patience of the American people. This is not going to be easy, but it is essential. We have many other things we're doing. We're trying to strengthen the communications effort. If you can believe it, the Taliban and Osama bin Laden have out-communicated us, the world's greatest communications nation, using low-wattage FM radio stations from the backs of pickup trucks and broadcasting hateful, hateful propaganda, announcing who they're going to behead in the towns and intimidating people. And we had no programs to counter this. We now have money, thanks to Senator Kerry, set aside for this, and we're going to be spending it. We are just rolling now in this effort. It may seem, well, you say, maybe you've had a year ready, what have you done? We've done a lot, but it is still a long way to go. It's a difficult situation. But I believe that we're on the track we have to persevere on. And I hope that all of you will understand that not every day will be a successful day, but what we're doing is essential, and we are moving forward. Well, thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If anyone has any questions, feel free to line up at the microphones and address the ambassador.
Ambassador Holbrooke, thank you very much for being here. My name is Keith Proctor. I'm a second-year Fletcher student. I'm curious how you would respond to the charge that the Karzai government essentially is a corrupt and extractive entity whose sole purpose or primary purpose is to extract resources from Afghanistan for personal gain, and that the United States, in at least some ways, is culpable in that process by both shielding and propping up that entity. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot for that question. Next. The corruption is endemic in Afghanistan. I wrote about it as a private citizen. Nobody denies it, not President Karzai. Corruption goes with almost every war, I think every war. Wars breed crime, organized crime. In this particular case, also breeds a narco culture, which has further undermined the system. And all I can say is, as President Obama said, we consider corruption a cancer which is eating away at the country. President Obama has talked to President Karzai directly about it. He has addressed it in speeches, in his inauguration speech, in his speech in London, and a speech he made in Munich recently. Our ambassador has been as recently as yesterday talking about this issue with them. There is an anti-corruption organization, but it wasn't strong enough. He has said publicly he's going to upgrade it. We are looking forward to that event. This is one of our two or three highest priorities. Having said that, I want to be clear with all of you that we were talking about this earlier with one of the members of the Leadership Advisory Board of Council of this institution, that corruption there's a difference between small greasing of the wheels, which happens in almost every culture, and certainly in that part of the world, and massive corruption, which requires massive amounts of foreign capital. There's so many opportunities now for corruption bred by the opportunities that come with this massive international effort. And so we have to be careful about ourselves as well. We have a major crimes task force. We've had some major arrests lately, some of which have not yet been publicized. We have two Afghan Americans in jail in Virginia awaiting trial on a huge kickback scheme that involved American road contracts. We have a major drug dealer in a New York jail awaiting trial. We're on the trail of some very big deals here, but this is not going to go away, this problem. It's inherent in the territory.
Hi, my name is Patrick Schmidt, and I'm a member of this year's EPIC Colloquium. And my question for you is, publicly you overtly go to great lengths avoiding saying the K word, Kashmir. As long as India and Pakistan are contending over Kashmir, how can a sustainable, reasonably peaceful Afghanistan ever come around? And what are you doing to?
I've thought a lot about this issue, and first of all, my job is not to work on Kashmir, and you're quite right about the K word. When I'm in New Delhi, especially, and in Islamabad, the journalists try to get me to say it, so I don't, and it's become a game. But here at Tufts on neutral ground, we'll say it. I don't work in Kashmir. Got it? Now, there is a thesis, a well-established thesis, which is you can read it in almost any issue of any international magazine anytime you want, that the solution to Afghanistan requires a solution in Kashmir. So when I took this job, I examined that thesis very carefully, since it's held by people I greatly respect. It's quite possible that Jamshad leans towards that. We talked about it. One of your colleagues at lunch raised it with me. Here's my view. If you link the difficult, very difficult problem of Afghanistan to the Kashmir issue, which is now in its 63rd year of not being resolved, you will only make both problems more difficult. And therefore, I have come to the conclusion, and my colleagues in the administration have come to share this conclusion, that to link the two works against either one of them. Now, I'm well aware of all the people who are going to make PhDs out of the opposite thesis. More power to you. I've heard the argument. Well, maybe in your case, a master's thesis. But more power to you. I'll read them all. But I've yet to see anyone who's shown me how addressing Kashmir will help Afghanistan. Is it a core issue between Pakistan and India? Of course. But is it going to contribute to the solution of the war? No. Not in my view. And we've spent a lot of, it took me quite a while to work this through because people I greatly respect, friends of mine, had argued the opposite. But that's where I came out. I know it's where Vali Nasser comes out, and he's a very influential figure in the State Department these days, and that's where we are. So it isn't just that I don't work in Kashmir. It's that we are not going to get involved. If the two countries wish to talk about the issue, we encourage it. But we're not going to get involved in the negotiation. It's between them. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Ambassador. My name is Joshua Gross, and I had the pleasure of working with the EPIC students this year. Patrick and I think are on the same wavelength. I have a similar question, so I'll take the opportunity to push you a little bit harder on India. When your job position was announced, there were rumors that your title would be special envoy to India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. If tomorrow President Obama were to call you and say that they will in fact go forward expanding your mandate to include India, would that make your job more or less difficult? And would it make you as a envoy of the United States more or less effective in doing what you do?
Well, it would be my last trip to India. First of all, I'm not a special envoy. I'm a special representative. And the words have meaning. That George Mitchell's a special envoy for the Middle East. I was a special envoy for Cyprus at one time, or Kosovo. An envoy, it's the French word, envoi. You go out, you do things. We run the policy in these two countries. We're like a mini regional bureau. Those two countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan, were removed from the South Asia Bureau and report to our office. Now, it is true, you're absolutely right, that at the end of 2008, there were references made to somebody who would work in all three countries. Those references were made without discussing it with New Delhi. The Indians do not want a special envoy. They're a great country. We have an ambassador there. They have an ambassador in Washington. We're not fighting there. Envoys are for problems. India doesn't need an envoy. I go to India regularly at their invitation. They treat me with great correctness and politeness, and I have the greatest respect for India. My relationship with India go back much further than my relationship with Pakistan. And since India has a legitimate strategic interest in what happens in Afghanistan, we work with them, we talk to them, and they do a lot of things in Afghanistan. They have 1,000 agricultural scholarships, for example. That's hugely important since agriculture is the most important part of the Afghan economy. They're building the National Assembly. They're building roads, all of which are very good. They all doesn't always cause, you know, the Pakistanis have their own suspicions about these activities, and it feeds into the larger narrative. But if somebody were to offer me that job to add India to my official portfolio, I would say that's not on. It never was on. It was misreported in the papers at the time that I wanted to have a responsibility for India. But I knew the Indians wouldn't agree because I'd been down that road in the past when I was at the UN. There was one time back in the late 20th century sometime when Kofi Annan was going to go to India to talk about Kashmir, and the Indians wouldn't let him as Secretary General go to India until he withdrew the reference. that he would work on these issues. So we have to respect the Indian position on this, and I totally respect it.
Hi, Ambassador Bob Holbrook. My name is Arjun Verma. I'm a student in this year's EPIC colloquium. You mentioned that President Obama, the entire administration, has gone to great lengths to say that our true commitment is not open-ended. And it seems like it makes a lot of sense. But if I'm an Afghan, if I'm a member of the Afghan government, if I'm a member of the Taliban, and I know that there are efforts to try and reconcile me with the coalition or with the Afghan government, I know that the United States is probably going to leave pretty soon, and they're planning to leave pretty soon. So my question is, how do we tell people that we're committed to this country and this region when we're already planning our withdrawal?
Oh, this is a extraordinarily good question. It goes to the heart of the strategic and political dilemma. And that's why I said in my opening remarks that our troop commitment is not open-ended, but that we would continue economic aid for years to come, and we would continue training, and so would the international community. What the United States did in 1989, after the CIA, Pakistani, Saudi efforts drove the Soviets out, the period covered in that movie, Charlie Wilson's War, then the United States turned its back on Afghanistan will rank as one of the great historic mistakes in American history. And by the way, for those of you who are students of government, if you go back and read the memoirs of the members of the Bush administration, Bush, Senior Bush, Brent Scowcroft, Jim Baker, George Bush himself, you look up Afghanistan, the index, there's always one reference. The Soviet Union left in 1989. That's all. And you go to the records, and it turns out there never was even a meeting in the Bush administration to decide what to do after the Soviets left. They were gone, we turned our back. And what happened? The Pakistanis, the country fell into a kind of a warlord civil war, and Kabul was destroyed by the fighting. And the Pakistanis, picking up where we left off, started creating the Taliban out of the debris of the Mujahideen we had created. And the Saudis were part of that as well. And that was a historic mistake, and it led directly to Osama bin Laden coming to Afghanistan, and you know the rest of the story. We cannot repeat that mistake again. And all of us have said publicly that this mistake will not be repeated. But that doesn't mean keeping combat troops there. We can't do that. The American public won't stand for it. The Afghan people won't want it. We must have the strategy, which I outlined in very sketchy form already, to succeed. And what we must continue aid. And every time I go up to the Hill, I raise this issue because I say, are you prepared to live with the consequences of the policy you're supporting, which means that after the combat troops leave, we have to continue to give aid. And we have to continue to help train and pay. It won't be cheap, but it'll be a lot cheaper than a military commitment. The war is going to cost us an enormous amount this year. Estimates range as high as $100 billion a year. The training and economic part of this is 10% of that. So it's the right way to go. But it's a very key question. And we don't want to leave people with the impression that we're going to walk away from the country or else exactly what you predict would happen.
Can I just have a response to that? Okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
Ambassador Holbrook, thank you. My name is Ravi Sharma. I'm a second-year MALD student at the Fletcher School. My question relates somewhat to the previous one. What I would like to know is how do we communicate to the Afghani people and Pakistani people that our alliance with their states is not an alliance with their individual leaders, but really with the people themselves, making that effect felt not just through military assistance or the delivery of aid, but really creating an alliance?
Another great question. Here we inherited once again a pretty unfortunate situation, almost a decade of support for a military government with no attention to the people of the country, just military aid, billions of dollars. We knew that, and we set out. I've now been to Pakistan 8 times, and twice in the last month, and I'll be going back in 3 weeks. And on every trip, we discuss this. We are listening to you now. We're changing our aid programs. We're not just giving money to the federally administered tribal areas in the West. We're also giving it to the people. After all, only 4.5 million people live in the West. You have 180 million people in the country. And what is the Pakistanis' number one need? It's energy and water. The economy is in very bad shape. And we were ignoring all this. Once again, Senator Kerry and his bill, Kerry Lugar, a Burman in the House, addressed this with $7.5 billion of aid in the next 5 years and money earmarked for transportation, for power, for water, plus other things like education and health. Meeting with the Pakistani Minister of Health the day before yesterday on how we can further assist him. We can't do it alone. I mentioned the Truman Doctrine earlier, and many of you will think of the Marshall Plan. That was a different era. We were 50% of the world's GDP. But now there's an international community which can rally behind Pakistan, and we have to do that, and we have been trying to rally them. And we will... We will continue to do that. The turning point for me was Hillary Clinton's trip at the end of October. She went there and she spent what's a lot of time for a Secretary of State, 3.5 days, barnstorming the country and speaking openly on live television nonstop to audiences like this. The quintessential question, which happened over and over again in various ways, was a young woman at one of the universities in Lahore who got up and said, "Mrs. Clinton, you're my role model, you're my hero, why are you supporting the Bush policies for Musharraf?" And then she just slammed into her. And Hillary, who's of course very good at these town hall meetings and who is the best public diplomat our nation has had that I've ever seen, she just said, "I'm here to discuss this. Friends can disagree. This is what we're really doing." And inch by inch, she tried to turn them around. Now, when we took office, Pakistan, pro-American sentiment in Pakistan was very low, 8 or 9%. Now it's skyrocketed up to about 20%. But, we're getting there. We have to just keep at it, though. It's very, very difficult. We are there to help the Pakistani people. And no one carried it, the message better than she did on that trip. And since then, we've had a lot of other trips. There's no country in the world we have more high-level visitors to than Pakistan. And we are doing everything we can to get that message out. But it's not always easy. There are a lot of anti-American elements in the media which misrepresent every word we say. And so we have to find better ways of communicating.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Babar Khan. I'm a senior at Tufts University. I'm from Lahore, Pakistan.
That was where the young girl asked that question. I think it was at LUMS.
Okay. So, Ambassador Holbrooke, there was recently a conference on South Asia held at Tufts University about a couple of weeks ago. The last panel was titled South Asia 2060. I'd like to ask you a similar question. Where do you think South Asia will be in the next 15 to 20 years, and you can talk about whatever aspects you'd like, political, economic, security?
I have no idea. I can tell you where I'd like it to be, but I'm going to leave it to futurists to predict. I'm just working this through. We have ongoing problems of an enormous complexity involving the lives of young Americans and the taxpayer dollars, and I'm just focused on those. I'm going to let the people of South Asia work it out for themselves.
Ambassador Holbrooke, I'm Catherine Munson, and I'm a member of this year's EPIC class. I apologize, I've been sick. So, my question is actually going to shift directions a little bit here. As we've seen since 2007, the Pakistani Supreme Court has risen as a pillar of power in Pakistan. So unfortunately, though, this is a region of Pakistani politics that is necessarily isolated in any federalist model of government. So how should American foreign policy experts respond to this shifting power dynamic? And secondly, how will this shifting power dynamic influence Pakistan's foreign policy?
Well, your description is pretty accurate. That was part of the process by which Musharraf was driven out of power and Chief Justice Chaudhry was brought back to his job. I myself went and called on Chaudhry to show respect for an independent judiciary. That was a very symbolic call. I think I was the first senior official from Washington to call on the Chief Justice. The relationship between the judiciary, the legislative, and the executive in Pakistan, like in the United States, is very complicated, and it shifts back and forth. And all of you in this room probably have views about the U.S. Supreme Court. All Pakistanis have views about the Pakistani Supreme Court. And I am not going to go near a exegesis on the internal politics of Pakistan, because that is their affair. They're a vibrant, slightly chaotic democracy that's still trying to form its situation up after an extraordinary period of military rule. And they're doing it in the face of these immense economic problems, energy shortages, which are unbelievable, 4 hours of electricity a day in Karachi, the world's largest Muslim city, last summer, plus the confrontation with their giant neighbor to the east, plus the fighting in the west. This is a country under great pressure. And in the middle of it, there are political events going on which are internal, and the judiciary is part of those. And that's up to the Pakistanis. They're operating in accordance with their own laws, and we're right in the middle of the situation now.
And then maybe you could summarize whatever
sure.
you want to
Absolutely.
Respond to at the end. So why don't we start with
Hi, my name is Asad Badruddin. I'm a sophomore this year's EPIC class. There's been a lot of talk about reconciliation with the Taliban and like distinguishing the Taliban as a strategic threat to the United States and separating it from Al-Qaeda. I know President Hamid Karzai has said that he's open to negotiating with Mullah Omar. I just want to know what your thoughts are on this.
My name is Ben Perlstein. I'm a freshman in the EPIC colloquium. I'm curious where you come down on the debate in terms of foreign aid to Pakistan on conditionality versus sort of letting the receiving people dictate the definitions of success when it comes to services such as education and health and the role of women, and how we reconcile our conviction to be effective with sometimes conflicting views of what success means in the country. Thanks so much.
They both asked my questions, so thank you.
Hello, Ambassador. Would you mind describing over the past year and I guess in the future how American foreign policy in Afghanistan is relating to tribal cultures there and how you imagine foreign policy, I guess, should relate to those cultures, since I feel like that has a lot to do with how Afghanistan regains greater sense of autonomy and independence in the region? Thank you.
My name is Mark Rafferty, and I'm an undergraduate in the EPIC program. And I'd like to know about Iran. And I'd like to know if you think that it's been overly ignored by the media and scholars and sometimes statesmen, and if the U.S. missed any opportunities of collaboration with Iran in the early stages of the invasion, and if you think there might be any hope in the future for any future collaboration. Thank you.
I'm Brian O'Reilly, another EPIC student, and you mentioned in the beginning of your talk about the capture of Baradar and how other Taliban leaders have been picked up by Pakistani U.S. authorities recently. I was wondering if you thought this was signaling a turning point in Pakistani policy towards, sheltering members of the Taliban or not, taking the story about in the New York Times today, Colonel Imam, the Pakistani general, or, is this just something that was opportunistically happening?
Hi, Ambassador. My name is Eileen Guo. I'm a sophomore at Tufts. You talked separately about continued economic aid to Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then you also talked about corruption and how there will always be corruption in Afghanistan and in that area of the world. So I wanna link the two and ask how is the aid that we are giving to Afghanistan and Pakistan actually fueling the corruption?
Final question.
Yeah, Ambassador, my question actually relates to Iran as well, and more specifically to its influence in the Herat province. And I was wondering whether you saw that as a threat to U.S. strategic interests, and if so, what you plan on doing about it.
Thank you.
We have some big issues to summarize.
Well, I think you, first let me say that I hope it will comfort you slightly if I tell you that every one of these issues is something we've been discussing at the highest levels of the U.S. government, that we really are thinking about these things. There's a lot of evidence that they weren't thought about in recent years, so we are addressing them. The first question is on reconciliation. I guess it was from Asif, a reconciliation with the Taliban. First, let's be very clear in what we're talking about. There are two different programs, reintegration and reconciliation. Reintegration is a program that is now being set up to invite people fighting with the Taliban to lay down their arms, renounce al-Qaeda, and join the political process. It's long overdue. There was such a program after the American invasion in 2001, 2002, and it kind of dribbled away, and they have to reinstitute it. That's a very important program. Reconciliation, what Asif asked about, is a general idea for something that isn't happening. It's the idea of whether or not there's a way that the Taliban leadership can be brought into the body politic at the highest levels. President Karzai has talked about this publicly. He's invited the Taliban to participate at the highest levels in the political life of the country. They have rejected it. The United States is not talking to the Taliban. There are no direct talks, but there are plenty of indirect contacts between Pashtuns. Every Pashtun family has relatives or friends in the Taliban, and there are plenty of constant contacts of that sort, and that's what you're reading about. The second question was from Ben, was about foreign aid and conditionality. That is a reference, of course, to the details of the Kerry-Lugar legislation I already mentioned. And here, a unfortunate misunderstanding took place between the United States and some elements of Pakistani society. In the legislation, the Congress put in some reporting requirements, which required the Secretary of State to report to the Congress as to whether or not the Pakistanis were doing such and such or not doing such and such an event. And some of the Pakistanis took offense at this and read it as an infringement of their sovereignty. And it was called conditionality. I'm trying to avoid the word because it carries so much loaded connotation. But the fact is that the Congress has every right to express its concern. And they gave us waiver authority so that we can continue the aid if we think it's in America's national interest. So let me be very clear. I share many of the concerns listed in some of the legislation. Not all of them. Some of them were trivial and some of them shouldn't have been in the legislation. But Congress is an independent body, as we kept explaining in Pakistan. And the money was made available. And it is flowing. And that's what matters to me. When Hillary was asked about this during her trip to Pakistan in a very contentious live broadcast with the Pakistani equivalent of 60 Minutes, she said something just off the top of her head which had great effect. She was listening to all this assault on conditionality and it was an infringement of sovereignty. And she said, you know, if you don't want the money, you don't have to take it. That kind of ended the discussion. So let's be very rational here. No country is perfect. There are plenty of things going on over there that you and I may not be comfortable with, but we are helping Pakistan because they need our help, because it's in our interest to do so, and because we want to work with them. And we now listen to the Pakistanis. The previous administration just did what it wanted to do. We check every foreign assistance program with their government. The third question was on tribal cultures and the relationship to U.S. foreign policy. And this is a very confused issue because the tribes are something that outsiders don't always understand very well. Of course, there are people, including people here at Tufts and Harvard, who've studied the tribes for their whole lives. Harvard had until recently a British expert named Rory Stewart at the Carr Center, who you probably knew, who was a tribal expert for both Iraq and Afghanistan. But in the end, we have to respect the tribes without ever believing we'll understand them fully. And that's just part of our foreign policy in that country as well as others. I'm going to duck the two questions on Iran, if you'll forgive me, because I'm not working on Iran and because it's I'm just not up to date on it. The question about whether the recent capture of Mullah Barada and others is a turning point is now being much debated in the press. And the question was, is it a turning point or just opportunistic? And the jury's out on that. All I can say is it's good news. It happened quite unexpectedly, but it's very important. And the series of events that you're referring to, and I could list seven or eight of them, all improve our situation. But I'm not prepared to say it's a turning point, just that it's good. And does aid fuel corruption? I thought I addressed that in my opening remarks, but let me just be clear. The outside flow of money, not aid, but more than that, trucking contracts, for example, of course they fuel the corruption. Everyone understands that. It's not easy to deal with this. We have to bring our supplies into Afghanistan over the Khyber Pass from Kashmir, from Karachi, to over the Khyber and into Afghanistan. And all along that route, people are attacked. There are opportunities for side deals. The Taliban stop the trucks. Warlords may stop the trucks. We have contractors. All of those things are factors. That's what remember I said in my opening remarks that we had one of the biggest corruption rings we broke up was involving American construction projects. So the answer is yes, there is a relationship between the outside presence and corruption, and we're very aware of that, and we're working on it all the time. And again, I don't want to speak about Iran except to say, because the last questioner mentioned Herat, Herat is, of course, very near the Iranian border. I've been there several times. To my mind, it's the most beautiful city in the country and the one I enjoy going to the most. It was part of the Silk Road. It had huge madrasas and mosques, and the remnants and ruins and reconstructions are still there. One of my biggest dreams in Afghanistan is to help save the great minarets in Herat, which still survive from the madrasa, which no longer exists. These minarets are ancient, they're feeble, there's a road running through them, and we're trying to raise money to save them. So you can see the signs of the Persian influence in Herat, of course, culturally. But the Iranians are not the core problem in Afghanistan. And one last point about Iran. Iran is a neighbor, and it has legitimate security interests in Afghanistan, which we recognize. Our problems with Iran rest in their nuclear program and other things they're doing, support of terrorists and other things they're doing, not over this issue. Thank you very much.
Some of you may have noticed, if you look very closely at Ambassador Holbrooke's tie, that he's wearing a jumbo tie. Yeah. So he was obviously well briefed by his Tufts students in his office. And I have a last question, Ambassador Holbrooke. When you get on the shuttle back to Washington, are you going to take the tie off so that Democrats won't think that you've gone over to the dark side? Thank you all for being here.